Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. This week's episode is going to be a very interesting look at the patterns in Europe and in Japan in dealing with changes in the population and inflation environments. To talk this through, we have Takeshi Tashiro coming to us from Japan. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. And we also have Jacob Kierkegaard, who is new at Bruegel and also is still affiliated with Peterson. And I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I'm a senior fellow at Bruegel, and I'm speaking here in my personal and academic capacity. With that, Jacob, can you help us get our head around why the Japanese experience is so relevant for Europe right now?
Well, I think it's because Japan has been there, if you can put it that way. If you just go back a couple of weeks and we had Mario Draghi lay out his report for what Europe needs to do to deal with the sort of overarching economic problems that it faces, and he predicated that, among other things, dealing with the challenge of aging, dealing with the associated issues. And this is something that Japan began to grapple with as far back as the early 1990s. And I certainly think that while I think it's true to say that the particularly economics profession has sort of coined this phrase Japanification, which was a word that typically took a very negative connotation. It meant low growth. It meant sort of indecision, politically inconsistent policy responses, and these types of things. As the rest of the world grapples with the same structural decline in population, I think we will come to witness, and this is particularly relevant for many European countries that actually demographically looks increasingly like Japan 30 years ago, we will come to see that Japan actually managed a very challenging economic situation not too badly, in fact. And that's why I think it's very important that European countries, but also other countries around the world, this isn't just a European issue, there are many other countries in Asia and elsewhere that's going to go through this. We need to look at what Japan actually did, what worked and what didn't work.
Takeshi, how does the Japanese experience look now? It seems like a lot of the reaction in the moment was more negative than the results have suggested, given where we are.
Thank you for having me. I'm Takeshi Tashiro. I'm a non-resident fellow at the Peterson Institute in Washington, so I'm based in Japan. I'm affiliated with government, but today I speak with my personal capacity, not representing any of the institutions I'm affiliated with. So in terms of Japanese experience, I think that is very important for the rest of the world. And many people think that Japanese experience is negative. Yeah, as Jacob mentioned, Japanification sounds like a very bad idea. But I would say that I'm very optimistic, at least by Japanese standard. I have several reasons for this. First is that economic performance, and another one is that fiscal performance as well. Because of the economic performance, Japan has been sustaining economic growth at least for the past 10 years. And even though many people say about Japan's fiscal kind of like Armageddon, but that's never happened. So there are some, I think, important lessons that Japan have to the rest of the world.
How do you think the experience with public debt can translate? I've often heard that Japan, because it has such a deep market for Japanese government bonds, is not facing the same pressures to keep its debt lower and has been able to really use fiscal policy to respond to its economic crisis in a way that's not available. I gather that as Europe's population changes, there's some possibility that this might have lessons where other countries can follow more successfully?
Yeah, as you mentioned, rapid aging affect fiscal balance to Japan. It is one of the main drivers of Japan's increasing fiscal deficit. As the population ages, tax revenue decline due to slow economic growth, while social security expenditures like pension or healthcare continue to rise. So those exacerbates the deficit. But even though Japan's debt grow to 250% in gross term and 150% in net term, and Japan still running fiscal deficit, the crisis never happens. Why Japan can sustain the debt? I can mention several reasons. One is that Japan has managed to control public spending. Its government spending as a percentage of GDP is much lower than that of European nations. I think that the European number is about 50%, but Japanese number is around 40%. Even though raising taxes has been challenging, Japan has been more successful in containing spending. For instance, we have a system automatic kind of a stabilizer of pension spending, which is called macroeconomic adjustment. So pension spending is now well contained, even though healthcare, long-term care, those spending are increasing. That is one reason. And second is that Japan net debt is lower than its gross debt. As I mentioned that Japan's gross debt is 250% of its GDP, but the net debt is relatively lower than gross debt. And the Bank of Japan, which is Central Bank of Japan, hold a lot of 100% of GDP of Japanese government bond. So the kind of difference is very important as well. And the third is that Japan has maintained economic growth through measures like Uma Mix, or perhaps we should call it Ageonomics, as labor force participation among women and the elderly has significantly increased for the particularly past 10 years. This sustained growth, even though we have declining working age population, and this sustained growth has also boosted tax revenue too. Last year, Japan experienced a record number of tax revenue. So even during the aging progresses, Japan can increase taxes. And the fourth, Japan still has room to raise taxes. Over the past 30 years, the consumption tax rate has risen from 3% to 10%, but which is still lower than many European nations. But perhaps most importantly, Japan has been grappling with secular stagnation. I want to say that secular stagnation as Japanification, which means that Japanese private savings is very high. On the other hand, private demand is weak, which leads to persistent demand shortages.
I want to come back to that, but before we get too farther into the new topic, Jacob, can you help us relate that to the situation in Europe in terms of fiscal room and spending versus deficits versus total debt levels? Where are we now and what lessons can we learn from this?
I think the key issue is, as Takeshi mentioned, that Japan has, yes, it has a very large, very high debt, but the cost of that debt is very low. And in fact, one of the sort of very interesting charts, if you plot the rise of Japanese debt with the cost of that debt, you will see that it slopes downwards, right? So the higher the debt, the lower the interest rate, which of course is not what you would normally expect. And I think the other thing that Takeshi mentioned is that the Japanese government public sector is quite small. It's about 30, 35, 40% of GDP on a general government basis. But more importantly, if you look at general government revenue in Japan, starting at the time when aging began, it was roughly the same, not much lower than it is today. So during the entire period from, say, 1990 to the early 2010s, when Japan went from a gross debt level that actually in the early 90s was comparable to the Maastricht criteria, just above 60% of GDP, 25 years later, it was roughly where it is today at around, 230, 250%. During this period of time, when the debt was rising very rapidly, also because of slow growth, of course, but government revenues were basically kept stable. So I would argue that what Japan did was a fairly conscious decision of, rather than raising taxes, it just let it use the credit card, if you like. And that turned out to be, I think, a good choice, because it turned out that the cost of that debt is very low. And I think, therefore, when you look at the policy mix that we're aiming for in Europe, where just look at the announcement by Michel Barnier in France, which faces a fiscal challenge. Certainly, this isn't particularly related to aging, but it has an aging aspect to it. What did he do? He said, well, we got to cut spending, but we also got to raise taxes even further. And France is already the country that has the highest share of the public sector in Europe and perhaps even in the world. Is that the right direction to go? Japan would suggest the answer to that question is no. Obviously, then you face the challenge that France operates within the European Stability and Growth Pact, which focuses on gross debt levels, not net debt levels. It has annual deficit targets. It doesn't have control of government expenditure rules in the same way that Takeshi mentioned you have in Japan. So I would argue that Japan's, in my opinion, successful fiscal experience suggests that we need not a small update of the Stability and Growth Pact. We need a very fundamental revamp of the very basic parameters. And yes, I know they're in the treaty, so it's very difficult to deal with, but that's what the Japanese experience implies would be the right approach for managing European countries' fiscal policies going forward as we age.
That's so interesting. As we move into the next section of our podcast, I'd like to come back to this idea that higher debt can coincide with lower servicing costs, which means you can pay for borrowing more debt with the same amount of money as less debt. It's kind of a weird trick like that. Jacob, do you have the sense this is because Japan was borrowing in times of extremely low interest rates, and so poor economic performance was what was keeping those borrowing costs low? Or is it more of a sense that Japan has the fiscal room because markets have confidence in it, and that is what has kept borrowing costs on the low end?
I mean, I think it's a combination of that. I think there's no doubt that Japan has latent fiscal space. I mean, if you look at the last 30 years or so, there has been attempts to raise, as Takeshi mentioned, the consumption tax has been going up, but it's still quite low. But the path of increasing that has been somewhat erratic. I mean, there were certain incidents in 1997, et cetera. But there is certainly latent fiscal space because the overall public sector in Japan is low, and I think markets recognize that. But then there is this issue also of if you have, because I would argue, certainly directly related to aging, a very low domestic demand, therefore very low inflationary pressures at home. Certainly Japan went through a prolonged period of time of deflationary pressures. You're going to end up with very low interest rates. We can debate what the neutral interest rate in Japan is, but I would certainly say that it is very close to zero. Markets recognize that as well. And therefore, I know that the Bank of Japan has been raising interest rates recently because Japan, like Europe, of course, imported a lot of inflation from global commodity markets in recent years. But it doesn't change the fact that Japan has had for many years a de facto zero interest rates. And that has obviously helped that. You could even argue that, as Takeshi mentioned, a lot of the debt In Japan's gross debt, about 100% of GDP is actually owned by government institutions. Overwhelmingly, it is reserved or earmarked debt, if you like, for the pension system. And then the Bank of Japan has, depending on your point of view, successfully bought up a very large amount of debt. You could even argue that they have successfully monetized the debt without generating additional inflationary pressures. That, of course, in a European political context, would be a rather explosive, indeed illegal, policy to pursue. But nonetheless, I think coming back to the Draghi report, if we think that Europe is heading in, at least partly because of the similar demographic transition, that Europe is heading into a period where our star will not, in fact, grow, will not be rising, but will, in fact, fall, then some of the same dynamics in Europe with very, very low interest rate and inflation going forward, leading to very, very low cost of debt also in Europe in the medium to long run, I think does suggest that we should be a lot less fearful of very high debt levels within our monetary union than the original design of the Maastricht Treaty was designed to address.
Takesh, how do you think the market conditions for Japanese debt plays into all of this?
I basically agree with Jacob's point that even though Japan's debt has increased a lot, but at the same time, interest rate has just declining. And I would like to add one thing, which is about G&R, growth rate and interest rate. Interest rate of Japan has been, in terms of real term, has been negative for a long time. And economic growth rate has been positive, which means that growth rate is higher than interest rate, which implies that debt is manageable. And even though Japan lands fiscal deficit, but the debt-to-GDP ratio has declined. So there's a room to land fiscal deficit while keeping the debt-to-GDP ratio stable. So I think that this equation, the inequality, G&R, has been important implication to Japan's debt situation, as well as debt sustainability.
You spoke earlier about Japanese savers. Can you come back to that and talk about how their behavior has played into Japan's ability to balance these trade-offs?
Yeah, well, the conventional assumption was that as Japan ages, Japanese savers need to dissolve their savings, which means that Japan has less room to land deficit because savings finance the government debt. But as the ages, we now understand that as aging progresses, people save more than expected or dissolve their savings less than expected, meaning that Japan's savings has just increased rather than a decrease. So that is one reason why Japan can still huge savings, which lead to lower interest rate as well.
Yeah, if I could just follow up on that. I mean, this is actually, I think, one of the key lessons from Japan, namely that the traditional dis-savings assumption in standard economics over aging is probably, if not outright wrong, a lot less powerful than many assume. And I think if you add that to that, one of the other experiences of Japan is that the domestic investment rate, as the population begins to decline, that actually also falls. And therefore, if we again come back to this notion of what is the equilibrium interest rates and what is the likely long-term cost of government debt, which I would argue is not actually only determined by Takeshi, as he mentioned, by the level of savings, but actually the intercept of savings and investment, that suggests that that number is probably, in Europe as well, going to remain very, very low. So some of the standard economic assumptions that aging leads to higher interest rates because there's less supply of savings to pay for higher debt is probably wrong. And I think, again, this is a pretty key lesson from the Japanese experience.
So interesting, the idea that savers will increase their preparations for retirement and hang on to these savings rather than liquidating them all of a sudden, which is a narrative that people used to talk about a lot. As we move into the last chunk of our podcast, can we talk some more about secular stagnation and what it means for the economy to be growing and facing barriers at different rates, and how this affects the rates environment? Jacob, this is something that's come up a lot since the global financial crisis in the U.S., the European experience. Where do we stand at the moment in trying to think about this?
Well, I mean, secular stagnation just basically means that the sort of neutral rate is negative, right? That's kind of the original Larry Summers definition of it. And as Takeshi mentioned, Japan was there for a very long time. I think many people feel that the very large fiscal expansions that we saw, certainly in the United States, but also in Europe and in Japan even, related to COVID, and then the subsequent the need for, you know, very large investments in the green transition, in the case of Europe, also additional defense expenditures, et cetera, has kind of offset that narrative a bit. So we are at a different place. I would say that, to me, secular stagnation is not just about the sort of where the neutral equilibrium rate is. It also has to do with other aspects of particularly the aging process, because I think one of the things that Japan has successfully done, as Takeshi mentioned, Japan now has, by a significant margin, the highest labor force participation in the G7. Both for men and for women. That's certainly a new development and a highly offsetting one. And it is also true that Japan is no longer a low immigration country. We traditionally viewed Japan as a place with very close to zero immigration. But actually, in recent years, net immigration into Japan is at a level comparable to Europe, the EU, if you exclude inflows from Ukraine, and even comparable to that of the United States. So while the immigration stock of foreign-born residents in Japan remains lower, on a sort of flow basis in recent years, this is not true. But the one area where I think Japan illustrates the problem is that Japan, I would argue, continues to have a productivity, total factor productivity in Japan remains very low. And that is probably the one thing which the Japanese government has not managed to fix. And it is, of course, also the core of, you know, what the Draghi report aims to address.
What I've always found interesting about these secular stagnation discussions is how they contrast with the stagflation narrative in the U.S. before, where you had slow growth and high inflation. In this newer narrative, you have slow growth, negative inflation or deflation, or at least neutral interest rates. And so you have pockets of the economy that are able to do well in those conditions, particularly public sector spending, that don't work in a high interest rate environment. How do you make the workforce work for you right now? I mean, Japan going from almost no immigration to some immigration is certainly a big change, but it's not enough to change the entire economy of the country.
It's obviously, as you have, and Japan shows, that when you have an over, in aggregate declining potential workforce or working age population, well, then government policy needs to be really laser focused on making sure that there are no, if you like, underutilized pockets of labor available in an economy. And in many European countries, that, for instance, mean raising, as was the case in Japan, female labor force participation. I mean, if you look at a country like Italy, that is still a significant issue. It will mean in a number of countries, I mean, this is why we debate in France, the raising of the retirement age. It means raising retirement ages. That is a problem that Japan has not had to the same extent, because the effective age of withdrawal from the labor force in Japan has always been very high. It means also in some countries ensuring that we bring younger people into the workforce much sooner. And then it means also, and this is an issue that I think Japan is still managing or struggling with, which is, it's one thing to increase the female labor force participation in terms of part-time work. But if you really want to fully exploit the female labor force, particularly one that is increasingly far better educated than the male workforce, you need to make sure that they are employed full-time. If you look at a country like the Netherlands, for instance, in Europe, that is a challenge there. It's a challenge for many European countries, which has very high shares of part-time female labor force participation. But then once you start to talk about that, you also start talking about, well, another problem that you obviously have had in Japan for many years, and you have many European countries, is very low fertility rates. And it becomes a challenge managing that as well. What do you do in a society when you have two parents working full-time and while still having fertility rates that hopefully doesn't fall too far below two?
But I want to add one thing, is that Japan's female full-time working ratio has been increasing, not decreasing recently. I mean, at the beginning of the Urbanomics, it was said that Japan increased just part-time labor, but it's not now. For young female workers, they started working as full-time workers, and they give birth, then return to full-time workers. So I would say that Japan has maybe looked slow, but has been changing a lot as well. So when we start, it might be small, but it's getting big. So Urbanomics is now changing a lot as well.
Yeah, I appreciate your bringing that up, both of you, because it shows the layers of productivity. One part is just getting more people working to do productive things. Another part is making those people more productive by helping them succeed in the workforce. And that is an area where societies can do a lot to help these very educated, very talented women work at the top of their game while having families. Historically, men have not been asked to choose between having top-tier careers and having families. They've had the supports either at home or in society to be able to do both. And it seems to me that a productive society that really is trying to get the most out of its best people will find a way to support those best people without telling them to make sacrifices in their personal life. This is not the have it all and do it all narrative. This is the, we want you to operate at your best, your most productive. And that means finding ways to share the load at home and share some of these other things. On the subject of productivity, we have these broader questions of innovation and preparing for shifts in energy, preparing for shifts in generally electrifying and making the world more green and more digital. How would you say this fits in with the quest for growth and the quest to live within our financial means?
No, I mean, I think in some ways Japan had an experience that fits the transition certainly implemented in some European countries, and here I'm of course talking about Germany, because it was obviously in Japan that the Fukushima nuclear disaster happened. The Japanese nuclear sector was then turned off for a while. It's now coming back online again. So Japan had for has had for quite some time to develop what Europe also had to do after 2022, which was a very large liquid LNG import sector. But that, of course, made Japan, like we were in Europe, very vulnerable to imported energy price increases in recent years. So in that sense, Japan is, like Europe, a country without fossil fuel, located there. We have to import pretty much everything. And that makes the green transition a terms of trade improvement for both Japan and for Europe. And I think it's worth mentioning here as well that Japan, partly for that reason, has always been a very energy efficient country. If you look at the energy usage per unit of GDP in Japan, it is certainly comparable. It is lower than Europe in the aggregate, and it is comparable to the most energy efficient countries in Europe. And then, of course, this, in my opinion, has a very direct link to what we should sensibly think of as productivity. When we're still in the fossil fuel age, this productivity has to somehow, at some level, reflect energy intensity and energy efficiency. This might be less relevant as we move into a fully decarbonized era, but in that sense, I think, certainly relative to the United States, both Japan and Europe sort of shows the way in which the greening of the economy can be, as I said, very clearly a terms of trade, you know, positive terms of trade shock, but also broadly a gateway to a more efficient and less energy intensive economy.
Takesh?
One of the challenges of the transition is that relating to the issue of today, which is aging, as the spending on elderly, such as pension, increases, as the areas of expenditure, like investment in infrastructure, are squeezed. So it can be a challenge for increasing productivity or other purposes to be financed. So, for example, for increasing the green investment, we need to look for other way to finance it. The government sometimes need to step in to provide public goods or to deal with market failure. But as the age progresses, it will be difficult to do that. So we need to find a way to balance the support for aging population and to deal with the challenges of the coming ages. That is one challenge that Japan and maybe Europe as well need to solve.
Is there any one thing from the Japanese experience that you would like to pass on to European policymakers and voters as they think about how to handle this? What should we learn from your collective experience?
As Japan ages, there has been a lot of warnings of fiscal sustainability. So we must be cautious about Japan's debt. As Jacob mentioned, Japan has weak demand. So we need to balance the supporting demand and maintaining fiscal sustainability. If we do aggressive austerity, which will weaken the economy, leading to self-destruction. On the other hand, Japan's public debt requires careful management. So maybe we need to live with debt. That is one of the lessons that Japan can give to Europe.
Thank you so much. Jacob.
I think I would absolutely share that assessment. I think the one thing that Japan can teach Europe as we, you know, will continue to debate our fiscal rules is that actually you can, in an aging society, manage even a very large debt load. And I guess I would, there's one other thing that I think we should bear in mind here is that some of the things that helped Japan age, the fact that it aged it to some extent alone, if you like, the estimated global potential growth rate for Japan when it started the aging process in the early 1990s was somewhere between 4.5% and 5%. If you look at IMF and other estimates for the global potential growth rate today, it's somewhere in around 3% and sinking. So Europe won't have the benefit of rising global demand, a rapidly growing global economy in the same way as it ages at home that Japan did. Secondly, Japan began to age at the peak of globalization, right? The end of the Cold War, the foundation of the WTO, free trade agreement was still a thing. And Europe is not going to have that luck either. So what that therefore means is that Europe, I think, will be even more dependent on how we manage our domestic demand. Coming back to Takeshi's key point, namely that higher public debt loads is actually likely quite manageable in this aging process.
I really appreciate your bringing that out, and both of you too, framing that austerity is probably the biggest danger and that all of the other ways to manage this situation are better than just choking off the economy, because without growth, none of this can solve itself. Thank you both very much for coming on the show. We have Takeshi Tashiro and Jacob von Kinkergaard from Bruegel and the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. You can find links to our research and relevant writing on our website, Bruegel.org, as well as this podcast and its archives. And we're out there on all of your favorite podcast channels. Keep listening. See you next time. Thank you.